Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show, the show that takes the mystery out of spirituality with your host, David Gagan, engineer, science director, scholarly researcher of life's mysteries, and author of The Endless Journey.
Welcome to the Common Sense Spirituality Show. I'm host Dave Gagan, and this is the show where we talk about subjects which are critical to our happiness and spiritual evolution, but all too often, we don't think enough about them. Please note that all the chat room questions will be answered in the chat room on next week's show, as well as posted on my website, which is davidgagan.com, hopefully within a day or so of the show. When you visit the site, you can ask additional questions, even about other shows. You can also listen to any previous show on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com by searching for either David Gagan or Common Sense Spirituality. I'm also launching a new podcast titled Aspects of Spirituality, which will be on iHeart starting in September. I'll be explaining my view and what I've learned about the mysteries of life in short weekly podcasts. I hope you'll join me there. Everyone criticizes themselves at one time or another, and this is healthy. We all need to spur ourselves onward on occasion so we don't get too complacent. But there are circumstances and occasions where we go overboard, when we are continually so hard on ourselves that we make our lives miserable. When this occurs, we need to back off and see the world more realistically. But how do we know when the balance is right? Self-compassion is the topic of today's episode, and our guest is Dr. Kristen Neff, a pioneer who first established self-compassion as a field of study a decade ago, and the world's foremost expert on self-compassion. She did her undergraduate studies at UCLA and her graduate work at University of California, Berkeley. Dr. Neff is an associate professor of human development at the University of Texas at Austin, and she is the author of Self-Compassion, The Proven Power of Being Kind to Yourself. Dr. Kristen Neff. Welcome to the show, Kristen.
Thank you, David. Nice to be here.
You know, I noticed in your background that you work with the morals of children. And I'm somewhat fascinated with this topic because I believe that, you know, if we want to rid the world of prejudice and materialism and egotism, we need to start with the very young. I'd like to see a school curriculum where ethics was as important as reading, writing, arithmetic, and science, and it continued right on up to graduate and specialist schools. Did you ever give that any thought?
I agree that ethics are very important. Actually, my field of study was looking at how children are kind of naturally born. They're able to reason ethically from a very early age. For instance, concepts of fairness and altruism occur by about age 3 in children. So it's not so much that we've got to inculcate children in the idea of ethics or morality. It's more nurturing what's already there, which to me is a much more hopeful way to look at things.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think when we're born, we are ethical. We're biased toward ethical, and then we're taught not to be ethical.
Yes. Middle school destroys it all, but it's downhill from there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. All right, self-compassion. How'd you get involved with self-compassion?
Well, actually, for me, it was part of a spiritual journey. My last year of graduate school at UC Berkeley, I was under a lot of stress. I had just gotten out of a very messy divorce, was under stress about finishing my PhD. And so I'd heard a lot about meditation and heard that meditation was good for stress. So I went to a local Buddhist group to learn meditation. And what surprised me was the woman leading the group talked a lot about the importance of self-compassion, of how we needed to be kind, caring, supportive toward ourselves as well as others. So I started trying it out. I started being kinder to myself, more supportive, more of a friend. And I was amazed by the huge difference it made in my life almost immediately. So really, my later work researching the concept, defining it, was really a way to try to show what I'd seen in my own personal life was that self-compassion makes a huge difference.
You know, self-criticism is socially sanctioned in our our society. Aren't you going against society's norms by telling people they should be a little easier on themselves?
Yeah. So it's true that people, our society is suspicious of self-compassion, and they think they need self-criticism. In fact, I think something even you said kind of showed that that perhaps you've even bought into it a little bit, the idea that we need to spur ourselves on with self-criticism. In fact, if you think of I define self-criticism as harsh judgment. You are bad, you're rotten, you aren't good enough, those types of harsh comments, as opposed to constructive criticism. Although we do need constructive criticism, we need to see where we aren't, reaching our goals, or where we could do better, where we made mistakes, harsh self-criticism is almost always totally counterproductive. Just like a parent, they want to motivate their child, they do it through compassionate, constructive advice giving and support, as opposed to telling their child they're crap, basically. But people confuse the two. And really, the research is very clear that compassion is a much more effective motivator than harsh criticism.
Yeah. Well, we're taught to criticize ourselves. When does self-criticism become a problem? Are there signs? Is there some point that we can look at ourselves and say, hey, wait a minute,
Yes. Well, see, the problem with self-criticism is it underlies most major psychopathology. So that's a problem. So things like depression, anxiety, shame disorders, the root of them are pretty much all based in self-criticism. So if you think of self-criticism as negatively evaluating the self, and this is the global self, it's not saying I did something bad. That's actually referred to more as guilt, and that can be healthy. This is I am bad. And judgments that I am bad, I am inadequate, I am unworthy, this really leads to major psychological health problems. And even if it doesn't turn into a full-blown, anxiety disorder or major depressive disorder, certainly what it does is it impacts your mood in a negative way such that it actually makes you less able to function well in the world in your daily life, and to be as competent as you might be otherwise. So really, I would say that certainly harsh self-criticism is never warranted. It's always counterproductive. Again, constructive criticism, supportive criticism, encouragement, kind motivation, this is always a much more effective way to reach your goals.
All right, well, let's put this in, give us sort of a practical example. We just failed a test.
Yes.
And of course, you're a professor, so you give tests all the time and you find people failing. What do we do? We just got an F on this important midterm.
Yes.
We think to ourselves, man, this isn't good. What's the difference between self-compassion and healthy criticism?
Yes. Right. So actually there's been research on this at Berkeley where they induce a failure on a test and they give people three sets of instructions, either to be self-compassionate about it, to boost your self-esteem. Hey, you're a Berkeley student, you must be smart, don't believe this feedback, or else kind of giving no instruction, in which self-criticism is the norm. And they find that self-compassion is actually predictive of trying harder for the next exam that comes up and persisting even when the task is difficult. So what does this look like? Okay, so self-criticism when I fail an exam basically looks like, God, I'm so stupid, right? Ugh, such an idiot. Right. And the motivation to try to improve, and there is some motivational power in it, people wouldn't do it if it didn't work at all, but the motivation to try to improve is to escape the pain of our own negative self-judgment. Oh, I don't want to feel like an idiot. Okay, I'll try harder next time so I don't have to hate myself. So although, again, there's some motivation there, the problem is the negative anxious mindset it puts you in, the performance anxiety it creates because it's, I can't fail because it's terrible if I fail, actually undermines our motivation and is much more likely to make us try to give up because we can't handle the pressure. Self-compassionate motivation, first of all, acknowledges that failure is part of the human condition. Just because I fail doesn't mean that I am a failure. It just means, okay, I failed, something went wrong. What happens when you do that in a non-judgmental way is it gives you the safety needed to look more carefully at how you went wrong, to actually learn from your failure as opposed to just judging yourself negatively for it. So for instance, in the study they did at UC Berkeley, they helped people, first of all, be kind and supportive to themselves in the face of the failure. They wrote some sentences saying, okay, well, it's normal to fail. This happens. This is part of the human condition. And can I look at it clearly? So the three components of compassion are kindness, common humanity, and mindfulness. There's lots of research showing that if you apply those components of self-compassion to failure situation, again, it allows you to see where you went wrong more clearly. It puts you in the supported frame of mind needed to do your best next time.
Let's go over those in a little bit more detail, because in the book you talk about the three core components. Why don't you expand on those a little bit so people understand what you mean?
Right. Okay, so the first component is the one that in a way is the most obvious and most salient, and that's treating yourself with kindness, treating yourself like you would a good friend, as opposed to the harsh self-judgment we usually treat ourselves with. It's funny, when people start to look at what they say to themselves, how they treat themselves when they fail or feel inadequate, like they aren't living up to their standards, they start comparing how they treat themselves to how they treat their friends, and most people are shocked by how cruel they are to themselves. The Bible says, do unto others as you would have others do unto you. But believe me, do not do unto others as you do unto yourself, because you will have no friends, right? We are often the cruelest, the most harsh with ourselves than anyone else in our lives, including the people we don't like very much. Okay, so with self-compassion, it means we start treating ourselves like a friend. We start treating ourselves with kindness, understanding, support, as opposed to just cutting ourselves down.
Yeah, you mentioned, you say something to the tune of, you have to ask yourself, what do I need right now?
Yes, that's right.
You know, that's a good thing to think about. You know, what do I need right now?
It's not just emotionally. What do I need right now to reach my goals? What do I need right now to succeed? What do I need right now to reduce my suffering? What do I need right now to be happy? Again, the same question a good, loving, supportive parent would ask for their child. How can I best support my child in this moment? So I use the analogy of a friend, but you can also use the analogy of a parent. In many ways, self-compassion is like reparenting yourself, right? Giving yourself the type of kind, warm, encouraging responses to difficult moments that most of us wish we had from our parents. You know, a lot of us, certainly no parents are perfect. So we're really kind of giving ourselves what we need at this very deep emotional level. So that's self-kindness. Another component of self-compassion, which is really important, and partly it's important because it helps keep self-compassion from being self-pity. A lot of people are afraid that self-compassion just really means self-pity, feeling sorry for yourself. Oh, poor me, woe is me, I failed my test, this is terrible, right? Self-compassion is the opposite of self-pity, partly because of this common humanity element. In other words, with self-compassion, we recognize that failure, imperfection, is part of the shared human experience. Everyone suffers, even spiritual leaders like the Pope or the Dalai Lama, they aren't perfect. They have their moments, and certainly their lives aren't perfect, because we know at the very least they'll get old and sick and die, right? This is part of being a human being. What happens, though, in kind of at an illogical level, an emotional level, is when we fail or something goes wrong in our lives, we feel like this shouldn't be happening. Something has gone wrong. It's as if, we don't think this consciously, but emotionally, it's as if everyone else in the world is living a perfectly normal, problem-free life, and it's just me who's failed, or it's just me who has this, difficult health condition. And the thing about that mindset, that kind of fallacious, you might say, mindset, is it makes us feel isolated from our fellow human beings. But when you remember that actually this is part of the shared human condition. Failure, feelings of inadequacy, struggle, this is actually what connects us to other people. It actually really helps us, it helps give us the sense of support and connection we need to do our best.
How rapid it is to forget that. We read people's autobiographies and we only read the people's biographies that, you know, that we think have done something that, you know, we think is really good. And so we think usually high of these people. And when you go through these biographies or autobiographies, you see all of this aggravation, trouble that they dealt with. And then you put the book down and you forget all about it. Oh,
that's right.
And you know, instead of trying to draw that to a broader conclusion that says, hey, wait a minute, we're all in this together. This is a tough situation.
And these moments of struggle actually are moments of growth, right? Our moments of redemption all come from suffering. So it's not like suffering's bad, suffering's a problem. It's part of being a human being. So that's
our
why
failures, the past- our failures are, seem to be where we learn the most. You know, when things go well, we rarely know why.
Exactly.
But when things go bad, we drag through all the gory details trying to work our way out of this fine mess. And that's where we do all our learning.
That's right. And that's so self-compassion really gives you the ability to embrace failure so that we can learn the most from it. Right.
Yeah.
And that's also why self-compassion is not poor me. It's not saying woe is me. It's saying this is the shared human condition. It's not self-focused at all. It's actually the focus is much more connected.
Right.
And then just to say the third component is also very important, and that actually is mindfulness. A lot of people have talked about mindfulness lately. This idea is really reaching the common culture. The idea with mindfulness is we are aware of what's happening in kind of a balanced way. Instead of being lost in the storyline of what's happening, kind of with this exaggerated, you know, oh, this is the worst thing that's ever happened. I'm the worst person ever, you know, where we're actually caught in the negative thoughts and emotions. Mindfulness allows us to step outside of ourselves and see, oh, I see, I'm really suffering right now. I'm really having a hard time right now. It's like, you know, the analogy would be if you're in a movie theater and you're caught in the storyline of the drama and they're about to push the heroine off the cliff and the person next door to you sneezes, right? And you guys, oh, that's right. I'm in a movie. This isn't totally real. And that's what mindfulness does, is it gives you that bit of space and perspective. So self-compassion necessarily involves mindfulness because we need to step outside of ourselves and notice, oh, I am suffering, right?
How do we do that, Kristen? How do we learn to be more mindful? I mean, we all kind of go along in our world at a certain level of mindfulness. I mean, what do we do to be more mindful?
Well, it really is a practice. Self-compassion is a practice. You know, our brains aren't necessarily designed to be mindful and compassionate. I mean, they have the capacity to be mindful and compassionate, and certainly to be compassionate to others. Mindfulness in some ways is very easy, being aware of what's happening in the present moment. But we have other tendencies of the mind, which is to get kind of locked into the storylines that work against the capacity to be mindfulness. So you really have to train your brain to notice what's happening, to notice. So what happens with self-compassion practice, usually the first thing that happens that triggers, you might say, the self-compassion response is noticing your suffering. It's like, oh, wow, I'm really struggling right now. This is really hard. I'm really having a hard time. And that's your signal that what you need to do is respond compassionately. So it is a practice, but it actually can be learned, and the data now is very strong that even people with coming from very traumatic backgrounds or with mental health issues can definitely learn how to be both mindful and self-compassionate.
The you know, we live in a culture of independent achievement. Is that a problem when it comes to self-compassion?
Well, it's only a problem when it's all about competition being better than others, right? One of the things I did when I first introduced self-compassion to the field of psychology was try to argue that it's actually a much healthier way to relate to yourself than self-esteem, right? Self-esteem for most people comes from being better than others, right? Competing and winning. And the problem with self-esteem, of course, is first of all, someone's always going to do it better than you do. And also because we are flawed human beings, we can't can't always succeed. So our self-esteem deserts us when we need it most, and that's when we fail. So self-compassion, it's not like you can't still compete or be involved in, you know, market capitalism or whatever your thing is, but the idea is you aren't evaluating your sense of self-worth on success and doing better than others. Your sense of self-worth is more intrinsic. It comes just from being, you know, a flawed human being doing the best you can. So, you know, in terms of, is it a problem? I think it is a problem. If you look at American society, we have an epidemic of narcissism, and there are problems associated with that. But it's not just our society that struggles with self-criticism. East Asian cultures like Taiwan, China, Korea, they also really suffer from self-criticism. So it seems to be a human thing. Yes. Yeah.
Well, you know, we think of self-esteem as a good thing. But what you're saying is that we take it really to an extreme, and you use, you know, you say self-appreciation versus self-esteem, and you're saying, and you're using self-esteem as maybe the extreme element of self-appreciation.
Yeah, I mean, there are healthy forms of self-esteem for sure. We want to feel worthy, like we're worthy, valuable people. The whole issue is, where do you get your self-esteem? Do you get your self-esteem based on success or being special and above average? In other words, being better than others? Those are unhealthy forms of self-esteem. But if your self-esteem just comes from, again, being a human being, part of the human community, doing the best you can, of course, health, self-esteem can be very healthy in that context. So it just really depends how you're trying to get it. And in fact, self-compassion is a healthy source of self-esteem.
Yeah. In your book, I kind of liked it. You said self-esteem should be the consequence, not cause, of healthy behavior.
Yes. Yes. That's
talk
right.
Talk about that a little bit. That's an interesting concept.
Yeah, so typically the way it works now, because we're so dependent on self-esteem, again, when we have high self-esteem, we're feeling like we're good, worthy people, we tend to be less depressed, we tend to be less anxious, we tend to have better relationships. It does help us out. I mean, you know, if you think about the opposite of self-esteem, which is self-hate, we know that feeling inadequate and unworthy will greatly undermine your ability to have good functioning relationships and to cope with your life. But the problem, again, is if we base it all on self-esteem, what happens when our self-esteem deserts us? What happens when we do fail? What happens when that person walks in the room who is doing it better than you do, right? And then if our self-esteem is contingent like that, then that means we can't really, always do our best. So if self-esteem, again, like I say, comes from this more intrinsic source, because I'm a human being who's imperfect, who struggles, but I'm trying the best I can, I'm intrinsically worthy because I'm part of this larger interconnected whole, then the self-esteem is there not only when you succeed, but especially when you fail. And that's actually when we need that supportive mindset the most.
Should we value ourselves for what we're good at, and maybe devalue ourselves, devalue what we're not that good at when we're viewing ourselves?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we need to base our self-evaluation on what we're good at or what we're bad at. I mean, from my point of view, our worthiness is intrinsic, because, you know, you might say from a spiritual perspective, because we're souls on this planet, part of this larger interdependent whole, we don't have a lot of choice or control over the causes and conditions that lead us to be successful at one thing, not successful at another. These are genetically determined largely. They're determined by our circumstances. A lot of factors go into it that have little to do with us. So from my point of view, our value comes just from being part of this larger interdependent whole. So we don't need to judge it as good or bad. It's like, it's just always there. And then once you start valuing yourself based on this criteria, because I'm a human being, I just have to say, there's a meditation teacher named Rob Narn in Scotland. I love his phrase. He says, "The goal of practice is to be a compassionate mess." right? If that starts being our sense of self-worth, just to be a compassionate mess, you don't have to not be a mess. You don't have to be perfect. But the worthiness comes from the kindness, the love that holds ourselves and others in all our human messy imperfection. That's really where I think the health is.
You know, I think it's a big help if we could appreciate how far we've come just to be a human being.
Yes.
You know, at the very lowest level, because when we start out, you know, spirituality is an evolutionary thing, and we start out where we're really a blank slate. I mean, we know nothing. We have no instincts. We have nothing, and we work our way up through the various worlds, spiritual worlds, through the animal world. We start out at probably in the mineral world. We go up to the plants. We go up to the lower animals. By the time we get to humanity, we've come a long way, and we've spent eons of time and a lot of hardship and a lot of difficulties. Now, we're not done. We got a long way to go, but we've done a lot. And if we could just appreciate where we are in this very difficult but highly rewarding struggle to get through, you know, I think we could see ourselves as a fairly fine being that's got some flaws that we're working on.
Yeah, well, you can see it that way, yeah.
So that's my view anyway. Hey, you talked about narcissism a few minutes ago. What is narcissism? Explain that to me.
Narcissism, sorry, I'm just laughing because I think we have some good public examples of it lately. Narcissism basically refers to people who just, grandiosity, who see themselves as better, superior than their fellow human beings. And there's usually a real fragility to narcissism. Narcissists can't handle any sort of acknowledgement of a flaw or a mistake. They get very, very defensive. Their tendency is to lash out and blame others if their ego is ever threatened. And so narcissism, you know, is very bad for relationships. For instance, if you're in a relationship with a narcissist, their ego is more important than you are, right? And like I say, there are researchers, Jean Twenge and Keith Campbell, have been actually studying the narcissism levels of college undergraduates for the past 25 years, and they found that they're at the highest levels ever recorded. Now, actually, they have leveled off the last 5 years, so it doesn't seem to be getting worse, but they really blame this on the self-esteem movement in the schools. You know, very well-meaning teachers and parents trying to raise their kids' self-esteem by saying, you're great, you're the best, you're number one. The problem is people took that seriously, people started thinking, I have to be the best, I have to be number one, it's not okay if I'm not, and that's where it can lead to narcissistic behavior. So self-compassion is not linked to narcissism at all. It's a totally different source of feeling good about yourself.
Yeah, but you know, we you mentioned this in the book, we live in a society of plastic surgery, performance-enhancing drugs, phony celebrities,
yeah,
like reality TV, grade inflation that you kind of just mentioned for students, you know, having to live in big homes, have huge debt, phony friends, social networks, for all our friends. Is this really narcissism, or is it a feeling of inadequacy? What do you think?
Well, the two go hand in hand, don't they? I mean, narcissism is, you might say, is a ego-based protection of feelings of inadequacy. People who can't handle feeling that maybe I'm not perfect or maybe I'm inadequate some way develop this shell of narcissism to try to protect their self-concept. So I think you really, in many ways, can't separate the two.
Yeah, I look at some of our popular figures, if you will. And I just get a feeling that it's more a feeling of trying to prove that there's something to somebody, but way deep down inside, have this huge feeling of inadequacy.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
It seems like they don't really have, you know, this is an outer shine that we're seeing, or an outer image that we put out, as opposed to what's really going on inside.
That's right. And it's certainly all the research shows it does not make people happy. You know, there's a certain level of material comfort you need so that you aren't hungry or you've got adequate shelter and et cetera. But beyond that, it doesn't lead to happiness. And, you know, if you live in a mansion or a huge house, you're no happier than a person that lives in a little modest bungalow somewhere. You know, things like relationships. And I do think the ability to which there's meaning in your life. We know that meaning is much more important than material success to determine happiness. And that's one of the reasons why I think self-compassion is such an important thing to cultivate, because basically what you're doing every time you relate to yourself with kindness, with understanding, with care and support, that's an important source of meaning that you're tapping into. You know, if you want to be non-scientific about it, and I'm fine with that, it's really love, isn't it? And if every time you suffer, you hold your suffering in love, then that means your life becomes primarily about the love that's holding the pain. And that's why it can be so psychologically beneficial, because you're resting in that mind state as opposed to being overwhelmed by the pain itself.
Yeah. You mentioned in the book that self-compassion is a better motivator than self-criticism because it's driven from love and caring as opposed to fear.
That's right. That's right.
That was really good.
Yeah, it's more effective. It's more sustainable, and it's a lot more enjoyable. I can tell you.
I feel that you had some. You know, reading your book, I thought you were pretty honest with some of your life experiences. I would encourage people to read Kristen's book. It's a very interesting book, and I think it's a book that people can relate to. It's Self-Compassion by Kristen Neff. Neff is N-E-F-F. If the audience is interested in this subject, which I would think they would be.
Yeah, but when I wrote that book, I mean, it is very self-revealing. Kind of, you know, I'm actually a fairly private person, but I knew that I couldn't come across as this totally together, you know, self-help guru who's trying to tell other people how to get it together. I knew that I had to have the strength and courage through my self-compassion practice to really lay it out there where I've gone wrong in my life, the mistakes I've made, the struggles I've had. And that was going to be the best way to communicate the message of how to be compassionate to yourself, not by coming off as some, you know, altogether person, because I'm not. I am a compassionate mess. I can own that. I'm a mess, but I'm a compassionate mess. And that's good enough for me.
How does forgiveness play into self-compassion?
Yeah, I mean, forgiveness is kind of, it's not exactly the same, but there's certainly a lot of overlap, especially with self-forgiveness, right? So really, when we forgive ourselves or others, what we're doing with the source of forgiveness, people approach it differently. Some people might use someone else as the vehicle of forgiveness, like God, for instance. But I think it's still similar. Basically, forgiveness has to do with understanding the complexity of causes and conditions that lead people to act as they do, right? So some people, maybe because of their upbringing or their genes or the stresses in their lives or various things that happen, are more likely to just take, you know, kind of unhelpful actions than others. So we don't have to blame the individual like forever as if you made a mistake and therefore you are bad and somehow you are excluded from the human race. Forgiveness is really a process of seeing, oh, I see how it's all connected and how things unfolded to lead to this behavior. So it's the same thing with self-compassion. And again, that's the common humanity piece. We have compassion for ourselves in the context of things we've done wrong. We aren't saying, I am bad. It's just really saying, I see how this behavior came up. I see the causes and conditions that led to it. And actually, the great thing about self-compassion is people are more likely to take responsibility for their mistakes. They're more likely to apologize. So in a way, by forgiving themselves for their mistakes and even ways they've hurt others, they're more able to honor it, to accept it, to acknowledge it, and then work towards trying to repair the situation. So I mean, self-compassion is broader than self-forgiveness because, you know, there's many ways. If you feel you're overweight, for instance, it's not so much a matter of you've done something wrong. It's just a way you feel inadequate. But they very much overlap.
Yeah. How about relationships? How does it, how does self-compassion versus self-esteem affect our relationships?
Yeah, it's funny. A lot of people are afraid that if they're self-compassionate, they'll be self-centered or they'll be selfish. And again, the research shows exactly the opposite. What we know is that people who are more self-compassionate make much better relationship partners. We did a study where we had people, you know, rate their own self-compassion level and then had their partners say, you know, how happy are you in the relationship? How kind and supportive is your partner? How controlling are they, et cetera, et cetera. And people who are more self-compassionate were rated by their partners as being much more giving, much more kind, much less angry, much less controlling in the relationship. Because basically, when you could meet a lot of your own emotional needs, if you aren't expecting your partner to meet all your needs, you know, exactly when you want them met, exactly how you want them met, you actually have more emotional resources to give to others, right? So basically, you know, and, you know, not just romantic relationships, but in parent relationships. You know, I talk a lot about my relationship with my son, Rowan, who's autistic. And I can tell you that I was such a better mother to him because of my self-compassion practice than I would have been otherwise. So for instance, when he was young, he used to have some pretty terrible tantrums. He was very autistic when he was younger. And instead of just focusing my energy on him, on helping him, on caring for him, I mean, obviously some of it was there, but I would actually focus most of my energy on myself, you know, telling myself this is really hard. You know, if he's having a tantrum in public, I'd be thinking, this is so hard right now, Kristen, I'm here for you. You know, what do you need right now? And then what happened when I did that is, well, two things, actually. One was it gave me the emotional resources to cope so that I was able to be with him without burning out. But the other thing it does, the amazing thing about self-compassion, is human beings are always picking up on each other's emotional states. We have actually mirror neurons where you can read and pick up on the emotions of others. So when you are in a state of self-criticism, when your mind is full of negativity and agitation, the people you interact with are actually picking up on that. But when you are in a state of self-compassion, in other words, kind of the sense of loving, connected presence, you know, feeling kind toward yourself, other people are picking up on that as well. So for instance, with my son, when I let myself be agitated or I started getting down on myself or making parenting mistakes, he would just get more agitated. But when I could be self-compassionate, he would inevitably calm down. So really, I think one of the biggest gifts you can give to others in relationship is be more self-compassionate. So they will kind of directly feed off your more peaceful, loving state of mind.
Yeah, so being compassionate to self-compassionate to yourself helps your child.
Yes.
As they learn to understand and they read that off of you. It's not just other people in the store. It's the child you're working with.
That's right. So the child, is your child interacting with a loving, peaceful, compassionate state of mind? Or is your child interacting with a negative, self-critical, kind of mean state of mind that you're inhabiting? And the child will feel the difference. And also, it will impact the choices you make. When you're, you know, thinking, oh, I'm such a bad mother. I can't believe I did that. I'm so stupid. You're in a more reactive mind state, which is going to lead you to make, you know, poor choices with your child. But if you're in a mind state of, well, you know, gosh, I made a mistake, but I am only human and I can see how it happened. You know, it's okay. These things happen. Let me try again. Then that more peaceful, calmer mind state, more loving mind state will actually allow you to make better choices with your child.
You know, this is, you know, it makes a lot of sense, but you know, a lot of us probably didn't grow up in all of that, you know, in a family life like that. How do people that grew up in a critical family, how do they develop a habit of self-compassion? How do they change themselves?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, just to kind of honor that, yeah, people who grew up with very critical parents, they tend to be less self-compassionate. You know, the people who struggle the most are people with trauma histories, people who are emotionally, physically, sexually abused by their parents, because then the people who are, you know, part of the compassion system, this caregiving system that is supposed to be healthy, actually gets mixed with things like fear. So it is more difficult, but what's really encouraging about the research is it definitely can be learned, right? So basically, a lot of it has to do with setting your intention, noticing when you're self-critical, and really choosing, do I really want to treat myself this way? Would I treat a friend this way? I mean, most of us, even people who are very self-critical, have experienced being friendly, supportive, and compassionate to others in relationship, maybe friends, maybe, you know, family members. So you actually have the resource to draw on. You know how to make your voice sound warm and caring. You know maybe some physical gestures that express care and kindness. We can actually use all those skills we've already developed toward others and start applying them to ourselves. So for instance, I really encourage the use of supportive touch, self-touch, to help, you know, get into a compassionate mind state. That's because the human body is incredibly sensitive to touch. We know immediately whether a touch, the warmth of the touch, the type of pressure we use is supportive or threatening or something else. So when you put your hands on your heart or you hold your own hand or whatever touch works for you, it actually immediately triggers your body to feel, oh, okay, I'm safe, I feel supportive. And that can actually set the stage for your mind to follow. So there are a lot of access points in. We've developed a whole mindful self-compassion training program to help people develop these skills. There's a lot of resources now to develop these skills, but you do have to choose to try to learn this new habit. It's probably not going to happen all on its own.
I guess we have to see what's right about ourselves, as opposed to see what's wrong about ourselves. We have a tendency, well, really in everything. I mean, you go to work and, you know, you don't, you know, the things that are working well, you don't pay attention to. It's things that are broke. So it's just a natural thing that we do in society is to look at what's wrong and try to deal with that, as opposed to stepping back and saying, well, you know, we got a lot going on.
Yeah, and there's actually something in the brain called the negativity bias. It's just as you say, evolutionarily, our ancestors who are threat-focused, always looking for what's wrong, were more likely to survive than our ancestors who were like, hey, that was a pretty good day's hunting, and they kind of chill out near the fire, and then they get gobbled up by a group of lions. So our brains are designed that way, but we can actually, that's one of the things we know about mindfulness training and meditation training, although there are many ways to access this, but you can actually retrain your brain to start being more habitually seeing the other side of the coin, which is the positive things in our lives and ourselves.
Yeah. How about gratitude? How's that fit into the whole thing?
Yes. So again, gratitude. Well, first of all, we know that people who are more self-compassionate also experience more gratitude generally. And again, you can cultivate gratitude for yourself. Again, our culture doesn't encourage it, but it really helps, kind of just helps us see things clearly, just noticing, lingering, even savoring our successes and not just, you know, being lost in our failures. So, you know, self-compassion, the idea of being a good friend to yourself, being kind and supportive. Imagine if you had a friend, a close friend, who did all these wonderful things for you and you weren't grateful at all. Well, you wouldn't be a very good friend, right? So if you're a good friend to yourself, that also involves being grateful, not only things in yourself, but also in your life in general. Really, compassion is the thing about gratitude really is gratitude is actually wisdom practice, recognizing how people help each other, causes and conditions come together to create things. There really is no separate individual self who does it all on their own. And so the common humanity component of self-compassion really naturally fosters gratitude.
Kristen, we've pretty much run out of time. What's going on in your life? How can people find out a little bit more about you? And
Well, the main thing I've been working on is, my website, selfcompassion.org, I've got a lot of practices, guided meditations, et cetera, on my website. But I've also developed this, like I say, this training program called Mindful Self-Compassion that's being taught all over the world, where people can, in their local community, take an 8-week course. You can also take it online to actually learn the skills of self-compassion, and that's really my life's work right now. I've already, from my point of view, I've already proven it's a good thing. I don't need to do that anymore. I want to focus on how to help people develop the skill.
Yeah, okay. Hey, thanks so much for being on the show. You're a great guest, and best of luck in all the things that you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it.
Obtaining wisdom is a long process, as no one can bestow it on us. The more we talk and hear each other's ideas, the more we'll be able to mature our own views. Questions and answers from the chat room for today's show and other shows are posted on my website at davidgagan.com. You can ask other questions directly by going to the contact section of my website, and I'll publish those as well. Also, I cover all these subjects and many more in my book, The Endless Journey. I look forward to sharing our thoughts every Friday morning at 9 a.m. United States Eastern Time here on W4CY.com. You can also find all the old episodes on iHeartRadio at iHeart.com. Truth is indeed stranger than fiction, and it turns out to be an amazingly good news story. We all have a great destiny ahead of us. Let me leave you with one last thought. You are a unique spirit having a life experience. You are far more important in the grander scheme of things than you can possibly realize. Enjoy your life. You've earned it.